crucial step in mood transformation, substituting a more rational, less upsetting thought in the right-hand column. You do not try to cheer yourself up by rationalizing or saying things you do not believe are objectively valid. Instead, try to recognize the truth. If what you write down in the rational response column is not convincing and realistic, it won't help you one bit. Make sure you believe in your rebuttal to self-criticism. This rational response can take into account what was illogical and erroneous about your self-critical automatic thought. For example, in answer to, "I never do anything right," you could write, "Forget that. I do some things right and some wrong, just like everyone else. I fouled up on my appointment. But let's not blow this up out of proportion." Suppose you cannot think of a rational response to a particular negative thought. Then just forget about it for a few days and come back to it later. You will usually be able to see the other side of the coin. As you work at the triple column technique for 15 minutes every day over a period of a month or two, you will find it gets easier and easier. Don't be afraid to ask other people how they would answer an upsetting thought if you can't figure out the appropriate rational response on your own. One note of caution. Do not use words describing your emotional reactions in the automatic thought column. Just write the thoughts that created the emotion. For example, suppose you notice your car has a flat tire. Don't write, "I feel crappy," because you can't disprove that with a rational response. The fact is you do feel crappy. Instead, write down the thoughts that automatically flashed through your mind the moment you saw the tire. For example, "I'm so stupid, I should have gotten a new tire this last month." Or, "Oh hell, this is just my rotten luck." Then you can substitute rational responses such as, "It might have been better to get a new tire. But I'm not stupid, and no one can predict the future with certainty." This process won't put air in the tire, but at least you won't have to change it with a deflated ego. While it's best not to describe your emotions in the automatic thought column, it can be quite helpful to do some emotional accounting before and after you use the triple column technique to determine how much your feelings actually improve. You can do this very easily if you record how upset you are between 0 and 100% before you pinpoint and answer your automatic thoughts. In the previous example, you might note that you were 80% frustrated and angry at the moment you saw the flat tire. Then, once you complete the written exercise, you can record how much relief you experienced, say, to 40% or so. If there's a decrease, you'll know that the method has worked for you. A slightly more elaborate form developed by Dr. Aaron Beck, called the Daily Record of Dysfunctional Thoughts, allows you to record not only your upsetting thoughts, but also your feelings and the negative event that triggered them. There's a sample in Figure 4.2 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. For example, suppose you're selling insurance and a potential customer insults you without provocation and hangs up on you. Describe the actual event in the situation column, but not in the automatic thoughts column. Then write down your feelings and the negative distorted thoughts that created them in the appropriate column. Finally, talk back to these thoughts and do your emotional accounting. Some individuals prefer to use the Daily Record of Dysfunctional Thoughts because it allows them to analyze negative events, thoughts, and feelings in a systematic way. Be sure to use the technique that feels most comfortable to you. Writing down your negative thoughts and rational responses may strike you as simplistic, ineffective, or even gimmicky. You might even share the feelings of some patients who initially refused to do this, saying, "What's the point? It won't work. It couldn't work because I really am hopeless and worthless." This attitude can only serve as a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you are unwilling to pick up the tool and use it, you won't be able to do the job. Start by writing down your automatic thoughts and rational responses for 15 minutes every day for 2 weeks, and see the effect this has on your mood, as measured by the Burns Depression Checklist. You may be surprised to note the beginning of a period of personal growth and a healthy change in your self-image. This was the experience of Gail, a young secretary whose sense of self-esteem was so low that she felt in constant danger of being criticized by friends. She was so sensitive to her roommate's request to help clean up their apartment after a party that she felt rejected and worthless. She was initially so pessimistic about her chances for feeling better that I could barely persuade her to give the triple column technique a try. When she reluctantly decided to try it, she was surprised to see how her self-esteem and mood began to undergo a rapid transformation. She reported that writing down the many negative thoughts that flowed through her mind during the day helped her gain objectivity. she stopped taking these thoughts so seriously. As a result of Gail's daily written exercises, she began to feel better, and her interpersonal relationships improved by a quantum leap. An excerpt from her written homework is included in Figure 4-3 on the enhancement. Gail's experience is not unusual. The simple exercise of answering your negative thoughts with rational responses on a daily basis is at the heart of the cognitive method. It is one of the most important approaches to changing your thinking. It is crucial to write down your automatic thoughts and rational responses. Do not try to do the exercise in your head. Writing them down forces you to develop much more objectivity than you could ever achieve by letting responses swirl through your mind. It also helps you locate the mental errors that depress you. The triple column technique is not limited to problems of personal inadequacy, but can be applied to a great range of emotional difficulties in which distorted thinking plays a central role. You can take the major sting out of problems you would ordinarily assume are entirely realistic, such as bankruptcy, divorce, or severe mental illness. Finally, in this section on prophylaxis and personal growth, you will learn how to apply a slight variation on the automatic thought method to penetrate the part of your psyche where the causes of mood swings lurk. You will be able to expose and transform those pressure points in your mind that cause you to be vulnerable to depression in the first place. 2. Mental biofeedback. A second method, which can be very useful, involves monitoring your negative thoughts with a wrist counter. You can buy one at a sporting goods store or a golf shop. It looks like a wristwatch, is inexpensive, and every time you push the button, the number changes on the dial. Click the button each time a negative thought about yourself crosses your mind. Be on the constant alert for such thoughts. At the end of the day, note your daily total score and write it down in a logbook. At first, you will notice that the number increases. This will continue for several days as you get better and better at identifying your critical thoughts. Soon, you will begin to notice that the daily total reaches a plateau for a week to 10 days, and then it will begin to go down. This indicates that your harmful thoughts are diminishing and that you are getting better. This approach usually requires 3 weeks. It is not known with certainty why such a simple technique works so well, but systematic self-monitoring frequently helps develop increased self-control. As you learn to stop haranguing yourself, you will begin to feel much better. In case you decide to use a wrist counter, I want to emphasize it is not intended to be a substitute for setting aside 10 to 15 minutes each day to write down your distorted negative thoughts and answering them as outlined in the previous pages. The written method cannot be bypassed because it exposes to the light of day the illogical nature of the thoughts that trouble you. Once you are doing this regularly, you can then use your wrist counter to nip your painful cognitions in the bud at other times. 3. Cope, don't mope. The woman who thought she was a bad mother. As you read the previous sections, the following objection may have occurred to you. All this deals with is my thoughts. But what if my problems are realistic? What good will it do to me to think differently? I have some real inadequacies that need to be dealt with. Nancy is a 34-year-old mother of two who felt this way. 6 years ago, she divorced her first husband and has just recently remarried. She is completing her college degree on a part-time basis. Nancy is usually animated and enthusiastic and quite committed to her family. However, she has experienced episodic depressions for many years. During those low periods, she becomes extremely critical of herself and others, and expresses self-doubt and insecurity. She was referred to me during such a period of depression. I was struck by the vehemence of her self-reproach. She had received a note from her son's teacher stating that he was having some difficulty in school. Her immediate reaction was to mope and blame herself. The following is an excerpt from our therapy session. Nancy, I should have worked with Bobby on his homework because now he is disorganized and not ready for school. I spoke to Bobby's teacher, who said Bobby lacks self-confidence and doesn't follow directions adequately. Consequently, his schoolwork has been deteriorating. I had a number of self-critical thoughts after the call, and I felt suddenly dejected. I began to tell myself that a good mother spends time with her kids on some activity every night. I'm responsible for his poor behavior, lying, not doing well in school. I just can't figure out how to handle him. I'm really a bad mother. I began to think he was stupid and about to flunk and how it was all my fault. My first strategy was to teach her how to attack the statement, I am a bad mother, because I felt this self-criticism was hurtful and unrealistic, creating a paralyzing internal anguish which could not help her in her efforts to guide Bobby through his crisis. David. Okay, what's wrong with this statement? I am a bad mother. Nancy. Well, is there any such thing as a bad mother?
Of course.
What is your definition of a bad mother?
A bad mother is one who does a bad job of raising her kids. She isn't as effective as other mothers, so her kids turn out bad. It seems obvious.
So you would say a bad mother is one who is low on mothering skills? That's your definition?
Some mothers lack mothering skills.
But all mothers lack mothering skills to some extent.
They do?
There is no mother in this world who is perfect in all mothering skills, so they all lack mothering skills in some part. According to your definition, it would seem that all mothers are bad mothers.
I feel that I'm a bad mother, but not everybody is.
Well, define it again. What is a bad mother?
A bad mother is someone who does not understand her children or is constantly making damaging errors. Errors that are detrimental.
According to this new definition, you're not a bad mother, and there are no bad mothers because no one constantly makes damaging errors.
No one?
You said that a bad mother constantly makes damaging errors. There is no such person who constantly makes damaging errors 24 hours a day. Every mother is capable of doing some things right.
Well, there can be abusive parents who are always punishing, hitting. You read about them in the papers. Their children end up battered.
That could certainly be a bad mother.
There are parents who resort to abusive behavior, that's true, and these individuals could improve their behavior, which might make them feel better about themselves and their children. But it is not realistic to say that such parents are constantly doing abusing or damaging things, and it's not going to help matters by attaching the label bad to them. Such individuals do have a problem with aggression and need training in self-control, but it would only make matters worse if you tried to convince them that their problem was badness. They usually already believe they are rotten human beings, and that is part of their problem. Labeling them as bad mothers would be inaccurate, and it would also be irresponsible, like trying to put out a fire by throwing gasoline on it. At this point, I was trying to show Nancy that she was just defeating herself by labeling herself as a bad mother. I hoped to show her that no matter how she defined bad mother, the definition would be unrealistic. Once she gave up the destructive tendency to mope and label herself as worthless, we could then go on to coping strategies for helping her son with his problems at school.
Nancy,
but I still have the feeling I'm a bad mother.
David, well, once again, what is your definition?
Someone who doesn't give her child enough attention, positive attention. I'm so busy in school, and when I do pay attention, I'm afraid it may be all negative attention. Who knows? That's what I'm saying.
A bad mother is one who doesn't give her child enough attention, you say. Enough for what?
For her child to do well in life.
Do well in everything or in some things?
In some things, no one can do well at everything.
Does Bobby do well at some things? Does he have any redeeming virtues?
Oh, yes, there are many things he enjoys and does well at.
Then you can't be a bad mother, according to your definition, because your son does well at many things.
Then why do I feel like a bad mother?
It seems that you're labeling yourself as a bad mother because you'd like to spend more time with your son, and because you sometimes feel inadequate, and because there is a clear-cut need to improve your communication with Bobby. But it won't help you solve these problems if you conclude automatically you are a bad mother. Does that make sense to you?
If I paid more attention to him and gave him more help, he could do better at school and he could be a whole lot happier. I feel it's my fault when he doesn't do well.
So you are willing to take the blame for his mistakes?
Yes, it's my fault, so I'm a bad mother.
And you also take the credit for his achievements and for his happiness?
No, he should get the credit for that, not me.
Does that make sense? That you're responsible for his faults, but not his strengths?
No.
Do you understand the point I'm trying to make?
Yep.
Bad mother is an abstraction. There is no such thing as a bad mother in this universe.
Right, but mothers can do bad things.
They're just people, and people do a whole variety of things, good, bad, and neutral.
bad mother is just a fantasy. There's no such thing. The chair is a thing. A bad mother is an abstraction. Do you understand that?
I got it, but some mothers are more experienced and more effective than others.
Yes, there are degrees of effectiveness at parenting skills, and most everyone has plenty of room for improvement. The meaningful question is not, am I a good or bad mother, but rather, what are my relative skills and weaknesses, and what can I do to improve?
I understand. That approach makes more sense, and it feels much better. When I label myself bad mother, I just feel inadequate and depressed, and I don't do anything productive.
Now I see what you've been driving at. Once I give up criticizing myself, I'll feel better, and maybe I can be more helpful to Bobby.
Right. So when you look at it that way, you're talking about coping strategies. For example, what are your parenting skills? How can you begin to improve on those skills?
Now, that's the type of thing I would suggest with regard to Bobby. Seeing yourself as a bad mother eats up emotional energy and distracts you from the task of improving your mothering skills. It's irresponsible.
Right. If I can stop punishing myself with that statement, I'll be much better off, and I can start working toward helping Bobby. The moment I stop calling myself a bad mother, I'll start feeling better.
Yes. Now, what can you say to yourself when you have the urge to say, I'm a bad mother?
I can say I don't have to hate my whole self if there is a particular thing I find I dislike about Bobby, or if he has a problem at school. I can try to define that problem and attack that problem and work towards solving it.
Right. Now that's a positive approach. I like it.
You refute the negative statement and then add a positive statement. I like that.
We then worked on answering several automatic thoughts she had written down after the call from Bobby's teacher. You can see them illustrated in Figure 4-4 on the enhancement. As Nancy learned to refute her self-critical thoughts, she experienced much-needed emotional relief. She was then able to develop some specific coping strategies designed to help Bobby with his difficulties. The first step of her coping plan was to talk to Bobby about the difficulties he had been having so as to find out what the real problem was. Was he having difficulties as his teacher had suggested? What was his understanding of the problem? Was it true that he was feeling tense and low in confidence? Had his homework been particularly hard for him recently? Once Nancy had obtained this information and defined the real problem, she realized she would then be in a position to work toward an appropriate solution. For example, if Bobby said he found some of his courses particularly difficult, she could develop a reward system at home to encourage him to do extra homework. She also decided to read several books on parenting skills. Her relationship with Bobby improved, and his grades and behavior at school underwent a rapid turnabout. Nancy's mistake had been to view herself in a global way, making the moralistic judgment that she was a bad mother. This type of criticism incapacitated her because it created the impression that she had a personal problem so big and bad that no one could do anything about it. The emotional upset this labeling caused prevented her from defining the real problem, breaking it down into its specific parts, and applying appropriate solutions. If she had continued to mope, there was the distinct possibility that Bobby would have continued to do poorly, and she would have become increasingly ineffectual. How can you apply what Nancy learned to your own situation? When you are down on yourself, you might find it helpful to ask what you actually mean when you try to define your true identity with the negative label such as a fool, a sham, a stupid dope, etc. Once you begin to pick these destructive labels apart, you will find they are arbitrary and meaningless. They actually cloud the issue, creating confusion and despair. Once rid of them, you can define and cope with any real problems that exist. Summary. When you are experiencing a blue mood, the chances are that you are telling yourself you are inherently inadequate or just plain no good. You will become convinced that you have had a bad core or are essentially worthless. To the extent that you believe such thoughts, you will experience a severe emotional reaction of despair and self-hatred. You may even feel that you'd be better off dead because you are so unbearably uncomfortable and self-denigrating. You may become inactive and paralyzed, afraid and unwilling to participate in the normal flow of life. Because of the negative emotional and behavioral consequences of your harsh thinking, the first step is to stop telling yourself you were worthless. However, you probably won't be able to do this until you become absolutely convinced that these statements are incorrect and unrealistic. How can this be accomplished? You must first consider that a human life is an ongoing process that involves a constantly changing physical body, as well as an enormous number of rapidly changing thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. Your life, therefore, is an evolving experience, a continual flow. You are not a thing. That's why any label is constricting, highly inaccurate, and global. Abstract labels such as worthless or inferior communicate nothing and mean nothing. But you may still be convinced you are second rate. What is your evidence? You may reason, I feel inadequate, therefore I must be inadequate. Otherwise, why would I be filled with such unbearable emotions? Your error is in emotional reasoning. Your feelings do not determine your worth, simply your relative state of comfort or discomfort. Rotten, miserable internal states do not prove that you are a rotten, worthless person, merely that you think you are. Because you are in a temporarily depressed mood, you are thinking illogically and unreasonably about yourself. Would you say that states of mood elevation and happiness prove you are great or especially worthy? Or do they simply mean that you are feeling good? Just as your feelings do not determine your worth, neither do your thoughts or behaviors. Some may be positive, creative, and enhancing. The great majority are neutral. Others may be irrational, self-defeating, and maladaptive. These can be modified if you are willing to exert the effort, but they certainly do not and cannot mean that you are no good. There is no such thing in this universe as a worthless human being. Then how can I develop a sense of self-esteem, you may ask? The answer is, you don't have to. You don't have to do anything especially worthy to create or deserve self-esteem. All you have to do is turn off that critical, haranguing inner voice. Why? Because that critical inner voice is wrong. Your internal self-abuse springs from illogical, distorted thinking. Your sense of worthlessness is not based on truth. It's just the abscess which lies at the core of depressive illness. So remember three crucial steps when you're upset. 1. Zero in on those automatic negative thoughts and write them down. Don't let them buzz around in your head. Snare them on paper. 2. Read over the list of 10 cognitive distortions. Learn precisely how you are twisting things and blowing them out of proportion. 3. Substitute a more objective thought that puts the lie to the one which made you look down on yourself. As you do this, you'll begin to feel better. You'll be boosting your self-esteem, and your sense of worthlessness, and of course your depression, will disappear. Chapter 5. Do-nothingism. How to beat it. In the last chapter, you learned that you can change your mood by changing how you think. There is a second major approach to mood elevation that is enormously effective. People are not only thinkers, they are doers. So it is not surprising that you can substantially change the way you feel by changing the way you act. There's only one hitch. When you're depressed, you don't feel like doing much. One of the most destructive aspects of depression is the way it paralyzes your willpower. In its mildest form, you may simply procrastinate about doing a few odious chores. As your lack of motivation intensifies, virtually any activity appears so difficult that you become overwhelmed by the urge to do nothing. Because you accomplish very little, you feel worse and worse. Not only do you cut yourself off from your normal sources of stimulation and pleasure, but your lack of productivity aggravates your self-hatred, resulting in further isolation and incapacitation. If you don't recognize the emotional prison in which you are trapped, this situation can go on for weeks, months, or even years. Your inactivity will be all the more frustrating if you once took pride in the energy you had for life. Your do-nothingism can also affect your family and friends, who, like yourself, cannot understand your behavior. They may say that you must want to be depressed or else you'd get off your behind. Such a comment only worsens your anguish and paralysis. Do-nothingism represents one of the great paradoxes of human nature. Some people naturally throw themselves into life with great zest, while others always hang back, defeating themselves at every turn as if they were involved in a plot against themselves. Do you ever wonder why? If a person were condemned to spend months in isolation, cut off from all normal activities and interpersonal relationships, a substantial depression would result. Even young monkeys slip into a retarded, withdrawn state if they are separated from their peers and confined to a small cage. Why do you voluntarily impose a similar punishment on yourself? Do you want to suffer? Using cognitive techniques, you can discover the precise reasons for your difficulties in motivating yourself. In my practice, I find that the great majority of the depressed patients referred to me improve substantially if they try to help themselves. Sometimes it hardly seems to matter what you do, as long as you do something with the attitude of self-help. I knew of two presumably hopeless cases who were helped enormously simply by putting a mark on a piece of paper. One patient was an artist who had been convinced for years that he couldn't even draw a straight line. Consequently, he didn't even try to draw. When his therapist suggested he test his conviction by actually attempting to draw a line, it came out so straight he began drawing again and soon was symptom-free. And yet many depressed individuals will go through a phase in which they stubbornly refuse to do anything to help themselves. The moment this crucial motivational problem has been solved, the depression typically begins to diminish. You can therefore understand why much of our research has been directed to locating the causes of this paralysis of the will. Using this knowledge, we have developed some specific methods to help you deal with procrastination. Let me describe two perplexing patients I treated recently. You might think their do-nothingism is extreme and wrongly conclude they must be crazies with whom you would have little in common. In fact, I believe their problems are caused by attitudes similar to yours, so don't write them off. Patient A, a 28-year-old woman, has done an experiment to see how her mood would respond to a variety of activities. It turns out that she feels substantially better when she does nearly anything. The list of things that will reliably give her a mood lift includes cleaning the house, playing tennis, going to work, practicing her guitar, shopping for dinner, etc. Only one thing makes her feel reliably worse. This single activity nearly always makes her intensely miserable. Can you guess what it is? Do-nothingism. Lying around in bed all day long, staring at the ceiling and courting negative thoughts. And guess what she does weekends? Right. She crawls right into bed on Saturday morning and begins her descent into inner hell. Do you think she really wants to suffer? Patient B, a physician, gives me a clear, definite message early in her therapy. She says she understands that the speed of improvement is dependent on her willingness to work between sessions, and insists she wants to get well more than anything else in the world, having been racked by depression for over 16 years. She emphasizes she'll be happy to come to therapy sessions, but I must not ask her to lift one finger to help herself. She says that if I push her to spend 5 minutes on self-help assignments, she'll kill herself. As she describes in detail the lethal, gruesome method of self-destruction she had carefully planned in her hospital's operating room, it becomes obvious that she is deadly serious. Why is she so determined not to help herself? I know your procrastination is probably less severe and only deals with minor things like paying bills, a trip to the dentist, etc. Or maybe you've had trouble finishing a relatively straightforward report that is crucial to your career. But the perplexing question is the same. Why do we frequently behave in ways that are not in our self-interest? Procrastinating and self-defeating behavior can seem funny, frustrating, puzzling, infuriating, or pathetic depending on your perspective. I find it a very human trait, so widespread that we all bump into it nearly every day. Writers, philosophers, and students of human nature throughout history have tried to formulate some explanation for self-defeating behavior, including such popular theories as 1. You're basically lazy, it's just your nature. 2. You want to hurt yourself and suffer. You either like feeling depressed or you have a self-destructive drive, a death wish. 3. You're passive-aggressive, and you want to frustrate the people around you by doing nothing. 4. You must be getting some payoff from your procrastination and do-nothingism. For example, you enjoy getting all that attention when you are depressed. Each of these famous explanations represents a different psychological theory, and each is inaccurate. The first is a trait model. Your inactivity is seen as a fixed personality trait and stems from your lazy streak. The problem with this theory is that it just labels the problem without explaining it. Labeling yourself as lazy is useless and self-defeating because it creates the false impression that your lack of motivation is an irreversible, innate part of your makeup. This kind of thinking does not represent a valid scientific theory, but is an example of a cognitive distortion, labeling. The second model implies you want to hurt yourself and suffer because there is something enjoyable or desirable about procrastination. This theory is so ludicrous I hesitate to include it, except that it is widespread and vigorously supported by a substantial percentage of psychotherapists. If you have the hunch that you or someone else likes being depressed and doing nothing, then remind yourself that depression is the most agonizing form of human suffering. Tell me, what is so great about it? I haven't yet met a patient who really enjoys the misery. If you aren't convinced, but think you really do enjoy pain and suffering, then give yourself the paperclip test. Straighten out one end of a paperclip and push it under your fingernail. As you push harder and harder, you may notice how the pain becomes more and more excruciating. Now, ask yourself, is this really enjoyable? Do I really like to suffer? The third hypothesis, your passive-aggressive, represents the thinking of many therapists who believe that depressive behavior can be explained on the basis of internalized anger. Your procrastination could be seen as an expression of that pent-up hostility because your inaction often annoys the people around you. One problem with this theory is that most depressed or procrastinating individuals simply do not feel particularly angry. Resentment can sometimes contribute to your lack of motivation, but is usually not central to the problem. Although your family may feel frustrated about your depression, you probably do not intend them to react this way. In fact, it is more often the case that you fear displeasing them. The implication that you are intentionally doing nothing in order to frustrate them is insulting and untrue. Such a suggestion will only make you feel worse. The last theory, you must be getting some payoff from procrastination, reflects more recent behaviorally oriented psychology. Your moods and actions are seen as the result of rewards and punishments from your environment. If you are feeling depressed and doing nothing about it, it follows that your behavior is being rewarded in some way. There is a grain of truth in this. Depressed people do sometimes receive substantial support and reassurance from others who try to help them. However, the depressed person rarely enjoys all the attention he receives because of his profound tendency to disqualify it. If you are depressed and someone tells you they like you, you will probably think, "He doesn't know how rotten I am. I don't deserve this praise." Depression and lethargy have no real rewards. Theory number four bites the dust with the others. How can you find the real cause of motivational paralysis? The study of mood disorders gives us the unique opportunity to observe extraordinary transformations in levels of personal motivation within short periods of time. The same individual who ordinarily bursts with creative energy and optimism may be reduced during an episode of depression to pathetic, bedridden immobility. By tracing dramatic mood swings, we can gather valuable clues that unlock many of the mysteries of human motivation. Simply ask yourself, when I think about that undone task, what thoughts immediately come to mind? Then write those thoughts down on a piece of paper. What you write will reflect a number of maladaptive attitudes, misconceptions, and faulty assumptions. You will learn that the feelings that impede your motivation, such as apathy, anxiety, or the sense of being overwhelmed, are the result of distortions in your thinking. Figure 5.1 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook shows a typical lethargy cycle. The thoughts on this patient's mind are negative. He says to himself, "There's no point in doing anything because I am a born loser and so I'm bound to fail." Such a thought sounds very convincing when you are depressed, immobilizing you and making you feel inadequate, overwhelmed, self-hating, and helpless. You then take these negative emotions as proof that your pessimistic attitudes are valid, and you begin to change your approach to life. Because you are convinced you will botch up anything, you don't even try. You stay in bed instead. You lie back passively and stare at the ceiling, hoping to drift into sleep, painfully aware that you are letting your career go down the drain while your business dwindles into bankruptcy. You may refuse to answer the phone for fear of hearing bad news. Life becomes a treadmill of boredom, apprehension, and misery. This vicious cycle can go on indefinitely unless you know how to beat it. As indicated in Figure 5.1, the relationship between your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors is reciprocal. All your emotions and actions are the results of your thoughts and attitudes. Similarly, your feelings and behavior patterns influence your perceptions in a wide variety of ways. It follows from this model that all emotional change is ultimately brought about by cognitions. Changing your behavior will help you feel better about yourself if it exerts a positive influence on the way you are thinking. Thus, you can modify your self-defeating mental set if you change your behavior in such a way that you are simultaneously putting a lie to the self-defeating attitudes that represent the core of your motivational problem. Similarly, as you change the way you think, you will feel more in the mood to do things, and this will have an even stronger positive effect on your thinking patterns. Thus, you can transform your lethargy cycle into a productivity cycle. The following are the types of mindsets most commonly associated with procrastination and do-nothingism. You may see yourself in one or more of them. 1. Hopelessness. When you are depressed, you get so frozen in the pain of the present moment that you forget entirely that you ever felt better in the past and find it inconceivable that you might feel more positive in the future. Therefore, any activity will seem pointless because you are absolutely certain your lack of motivation and sense of oppression are unending and irreversible. From this perspective, the suggestion that you do something to help yourself might sound as ludicrous and insensitive as telling a dying man to cheer up. 2. Helplessness. You can't possibly do anything that will make yourself feel better because you are convinced that your moods are caused by factors beyond your control, such as fate, hormone cycles, dietary factors, luck, and other people's evaluations of you. 3. Overwhelming yourself. There are several ways you may overwhelm yourself into doing nothing. You may magnify a task to the degree that it seems impossible to tackle. You may assume you must do everything at once instead of breaking each job down into small, discrete, manageable units, which you can complete one step at a time. You might also inadvertently distract yourself from the task at hand by obsessing about endless other things you haven't gotten around to doing yet. To illustrate how irrational this is, imagine that every time you sat down to eat, you thought about all the food you would have to eat during your lifetime. Just imagine for a moment that all piled up in front of you are tons of meat, vegetables, ice cream, and thousands of gallons of fluids. And you would have to eat every bit of this food before you die. Now suppose that before every meal you said to yourself, "This meal is just a drop in the bucket. How can I ever get all that food eaten? There's just no point in eating one pitiful hamburger tonight." You'd feel so nauseated and overwhelmed your appetite would vanish, and your stomach would turn into a knot. When you think about all the things you were putting off, you do this very same thing without being aware of it. 4. Jumping to conclusions. You sense that it's not within your power to take effective action that will result in satisfaction because you are in the habit of saying, "I can't," or "I would, but..." Thus, when I suggested that a depressed woman bake an apple pie, she responded, "I can't cook anymore." What she really meant to say was, "I have the feeling I wouldn't enjoy cooking, and it seems like it would be awfully difficult." When she tested these assumptions by attempting to bake a pie, she found it surprisingly satisfying and not at all difficult. 5. Self-labeling. The more you procrastinate, the more you condemn yourself as inferior. This saps your self-confidence further. The problem is compounded when you label yourself a procrastinator or a lazy person. This causes you to see your lack of effective action as the real you, so that you automatically expect little or nothing from yourself. 6. Undervaluing the rewards. When you are depressed, you may fail to initiate any meaningful activity not only because you conceive of any task as terribly difficult, but also because you feel the reward simply wouldn't be worth the effort. Anhedonia is the technical name for a diminished ability to experience satisfaction and pleasure. A common thinking error, your tendency to disqualify the positive, may be at the root of this problem. Do you recall what this thinking error consists of? A businessman complained to me that nothing he did all day was satisfying. He explained that in the morning he had attempted to return a call from a client, but found the line was busy. As he hung up, he told himself, that was a waste of time. Later in the morning, he successfully completed an important business negotiation. This time he told himself, anyone in our firm could have handled it just as well or better. It was an easy problem, and so my role wasn't really important. His lack of satisfaction results from the fact that he always finds a way to discredit his efforts. His bad habit of saying, it doesn't count, successfully torpedoes any sense of fulfillment. 7. Perfectionism. You defeat yourself with inappropriate goals and standards. You will settle for nothing short of a magnificent performance in anything you do, so you frequently end up having to settle for just that. Nothing. 8. Fear of failure. Another mindset which paralyzes you is the fear of failure, because you imagine that putting in the effort and not succeeding would be an overwhelming personal defeat. You refuse to try at all. Several thinking errors are involved in the fear of failure. One of the most common is overgeneralization. You reason, if I fail at this, it means I will fail at anything. This, of course, is impossible. Nobody can fail at everything. We all have our share of victories and defeats. While it is true that victory tastes sweet and defeat is often bitter, failing at any task need not be a fatal poison, and the bad taste will not linger forever. A second mindset that contributes to the fear of defeat is when you evaluate your performance exclusively on the outcome regardless of your individual effort. This is illogical and reflects a product orientation rather than a process orientation. Let me explain this with a personal example. As a psychotherapist, I can control only what I say and how I interact with each patient. I cannot control how any particular patient will respond to my efforts during a given therapy session. What I say and how I interact is the process. How each individual reacts is the product. In any given day, several patients will report that they have benefited greatly from that day's session, while a couple of others will tell me that their session was not particularly helpful. If I evaluated my work exclusively on the outcome or product, I would experience a sense of exhilaration whenever a patient did well, and feel defeated and defective whenever a patient reacted negatively. This would make my emotional life a roller coaster, and my self-esteem would go up and down in an exhausting and unpredictable manner all day long. But if I admit to myself that all I can control is the input I provide in the therapeutic process, I can pride myself on good, consistent work regardless of the outcome of any particular session. It was a great personal victory when I learned to evaluate my work based on the process rather than on the product. If a patient gives me a negative report, I try to learn from it. If I did make an error, I attempt to correct it, but I don't need to jump out the window. 9. Fear of success. Because of your lack of confidence, success may seem even more risky than failure, because you are certain it is based on chance. Therefore, you are convinced you couldn't keep it up, and you feel your accomplishments will falsely raise the expectations of others. Then when the awful truth that you are basically a loser ultimately comes out, the disappointment, rejection, and pain will be all the more bitter. Since you feel sure you will eventually fall off the cliff, it seems safer not to go mountain climbing at all. You may also fear success because you anticipate that people will make even greater demands on you, because you are convinced you must and can't meet their expectations. Success would put you into a dangerous and impossible situation. Therefore, you try to maintain control by avoiding any commitment or involvement. 10. Fear of disapproval or criticism. You imagine that if you try something new, any mistake or flub will be met with strong disapproval and criticism because the people you care about won't accept you if you are human and imperfect. The risk of rejection seems so dangerous that to protect yourself, you adopt as low a profile as possible. If you don't make any effort, you can't goof up. 11. Coercion and resentment. A deadly enemy of motivation is a sense of coercion. You feel under intense pressure to perform, generated from within and without. This happens when you try to motivate yourself with moralistic shoulds and oughts. You tell yourself, I should do this, and I have to do that. Then you feel obliged, burdened, tense, resentful, and guilty. You feel like a delinquent child under the discipline of a tyrannical probation officer. Every task becomes colored with such unpleasantness that you can't stand to face it. Then as you procrastinate, you condemn yourself as a lazy, no-good bum. This further drains your energies. 12. Low frustration tolerance. You assume that you should be able to solve your problems and reach your goals rapidly and easily, so you go into a frenzied state of panic and rage when life presents you with obstacles. Rather than persist patiently over a period of time, you may retaliate against the unfairness of it all when things get tough, so you give up completely. I also call this the entitlement syndrome, because you feel and act as if you were entitled to success, love, approval, perfect health, happiness, etc. Your frustration results from your habit of comparing reality with an ideal in your head. When the two don't match, you condemn reality. It doesn't occur to you that it might be infinitely easier simply to change your expectations than to bend and twist reality. This frustration is frequently generated by should statements. While jogging, you might complain, "For all the miles I've gone, I should be in better shape by now." Indeed, why should you? You may have the illusion that such punishing, demanding statements will help you by driving you on to try harder and to put out more effort. It rarely works this way. The frustration just adds to your sense of futility and increases your urge to give up and do nothing. 13. Guilt and self-blame. If you are frozen in the conviction you are bad or have let others down, you will naturally feel unmotivated to pursue your daily life. I recently treated a lonely elderly woman who spent her days in bed in spite of the fact that she felt better when she shopped, cooked, and socialized with her friends. Why? This sweet woman was holding herself responsible for her daughter's divorce 5 years earlier. She explained, "When I visited them, I should have sat down and talked things over with my son-in-law. I should have asked him how things were going. Maybe I could have helped. I wanted to, and yet I didn't take the opportunity. Now I feel I failed them." After we reviewed the illogic in her thinking, she felt better immediately and became active again. Because she was human and not God, she could not have been expected to predict the future or to know precisely how to intervene. By now you may be thinking, so what? I know that my do-nothingism is, in a way, illogical and self-defeating. I can see myself in several of the mental sets you've described. But I feel like I'm trying to wade through a pool of molasses. I just can't get myself going. You may say all this oppression just results from my attitudes, but it feels like a ton of bricks. So what can I do about it? Do you know why virtually any meaningful activity has a decent chance of brightening your mood? If you do nothing, you will become preoccupied with the flood of negative, destructive thoughts. If you do something, you will be temporarily distracted from that internal dialogue of self-denigration. What is even more important? The sense of mastery you will experience will disprove many of the distorted thoughts that slowed you down in the first place. As you review the following self-activation techniques, choose a couple that appeal most to you and work at them for a week or two. Remember, you don't have to master them all. One man's salvation can be another's curse. Use the methods that seem the most tailored to your particular brand of procrastination. The Daily Activity Schedule. The Daily Activity Schedule, reproduced in Figure 5-2 on the enhancement, is simple but effective, and can help you get organized in your fight against lethargy and apathy. The schedule consists of two parts. In the perspective column, write out an hour-by-hour plan for what you would like to accomplish each day. Even though you may actually carry out only a portion of your plan, the simple act of creating a method of action every day can be immensely helpful. Your plans need not be elaborate. Just put one or two words in each time slot to indicate what you'd like to do, such as dress, eat lunch, prepare a resume, etc. It should not require more than 5 minutes to do this. At the end of the day, fill out the retrospective column. Record in each time slot what you actually did during the day. This may be the same as or different from what you actually planned. Nevertheless, even if it was just staring at the wall, write it down. In addition, label each activity with the letter M for mastery or the letter P for pleasure. Mastery activities are those which represent some accomplishment, such as brushing your teeth, cooking dinner, driving to work, etc. Pleasure might include reading a book, eating, going to a movie, etc. After you have written M or P for each activity, estimate the actual amount of pleasure or the degree of difficulty in the task by using a 0 to 5 rating. For example, you could give yourself a score of M1 for a particularly easy task like getting dressed, while M4 or M5 would indicate you did something more difficult and challenging, such as not eating too much or applying for a job. You can rate the pleasure activities in a similar manner. If any activity was pleasurable in the past when you were not depressed, but today it was nearly or totally devoid of pleasure, put a P-1/2 or a P-0. Some activities, such as cooking dinner, can be labeled M and P. Why is this simple activity schedule likely to be helpful? First, it will undercut your tendency to obsess endlessly about the value of various activities and to debate counterproductively about whether or not to do something. Accomplishing even a part of your scheduled activities will in all probability give you some satisfaction and will combat your depression. As you plan your day, develop a balanced program that provides for enjoyable leisure activities as well as work. If you are feeling blue, you may want to put a special emphasis on fun, even if you doubt you can enjoy things as much as usual. You may be depleted from having asked too much of yourself, causing an imbalance in your give-and-get system. If so, take a few days of vacation and schedule only those things you want to do. If you adhere to the schedule, you will find your motivation increasing. As you start doing things, you will begin to disprove your belief that you are incapable of functioning effectively. As one procrastinator reported, "By scheduling my day and comparing the results, I have become aware of how I spend my time. This has helped me take charge of my life once again. I realize that I can be in control if I want to." Keep this daily activity schedule for at least a week. As you review the activities in which you participated during the previous week, you will see that some have given you a greater sense of mastery and pleasure. As indicated by higher scores, as you continue planning each upcoming day, use this information to schedule more of those activities and avoid others which are associated with lower satisfaction levels. The daily activity schedule can be especially helpful for a common syndrome I call the weekend holiday blues. This is a pattern of depression most often reflected in people who are single and have their greatest emotional difficulties when alone. If you fit this description, you probably assume these periods are bound to be unbearable, so you do very little to care for yourself creatively. You stare at the walls and mope, or lie in bed all day, Saturday and Sunday, or, for good times, you watch a boring TV show and eat a meager dinner of a peanut butter sandwich and a cup of instant coffee. No wonder your weekends are tough. Not only are you depressed and alone, but you treat yourself in a way that can only inflict pain. Would you treat someone else in such a sadistic manner? These weekend blues can be overcome by using the daily activity schedule. On Friday night, schedule some plans for Saturday on an hourly basis. You may resist this, saying, "What's the point? I'm all alone." The fact that you are all alone is the very reason for using the schedule. Why assume you're bound to be miserable? This prediction can function only as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Put it to the test by adopting a productive approach. Your plans need not be elaborate in order to be helpful. You can schedule going to the hairdresser, shopping, visiting an art museum, reading a book, or walking through the park. You will discover that laying out and adhering to a simple plan for the day can go a long way toward lifting your mood. And who knows, if you're willing to care for yourself, you may suddenly notice that others will act more interested in you as well. At the end of the day, before you go to bed, write down what you actually did each hour and rate each activity for mastery and pleasure. Then, make out a new schedule for the following day. This simple procedure may be the first step toward a sense of self-respect and genuine self-reliance. The Anti-Procrastination Sheet. In Figure 5-3 is a form I have found effective in breaking the habit of procrastination. You may be avoiding a particular activity because you predict it will be too difficult and unrewarding. Using the Anti-Procrastination Sheet, you can train yourself to test these negative predictions. Each day, write down in the appropriate column one or more tasks you have been putting off. If the task requires substantial time and effort, it is best to break it down into a series of small steps so that each one can be completed in 15 minutes or less. Now write down in the next column how difficult you predict each step of the task will be, using a 0 to 100% scale. If you imagine the task will be easy, you can write down a low estimate, such as 10 to 20%. For harder tasks, use 80 to 90%. In the next column, write down your prediction of how satisfying and rewarding it will be to complete each phase of the task, again using the percentage system. Once you've recorded these predictions, go ahead and complete the first step of the task. After you've completed each step, take note of how difficult it actually turned out to be, as well as the amount of pleasure you gained from doing it. Record this information in the last two columns, again using the percentage system. Take a look at Figure 5-3 on the enhancement. It shows how a college professor used this form to overcome several months of putting off writing a letter, applying for a teaching position opening up at another university. As you can see, he anticipated that writing the letter would be difficult and unrewarding. After he recorded his pessimistic predictions, he became curious to outline the letter and prepare a rough draft to see if it would be as tedious and unrewarding as he thought. He found to his great surprise that it turned out to be easy and satisfying, and he felt sufficiently motivated that he went on to complete the letter. He recorded this data in the last two columns. The information gained from this experiment so greatly astonished him that he used the anti-procrastination sheet in many other areas in his life. Consequently, his productivity and self-confidence underwent a dramatic increase, and his depression disappeared. Daily record of dysfunctional thoughts. This record, introduced in Chapter 4, can be used to great advantage when you are overwhelmed by the urge to do nothing. Simply write down the thoughts that run through your mind when you think about a particular task. This will immediately show you what your problem is. Then write down appropriate rational responses that show these thoughts are unrealistic. This will help you mobilize enough energy to take that first difficult step. Once you've done that, you will gain momentum and be on your way. An example of this approach is indicated in Figure 5-4. Annette is an attractive, young, single woman who owns and operates a successful boutique. She is patient A, described previously. She does well during the week because of all the bustle at her store. On weekends, she tends to hide away in bed unless she has social activities lined up. The moment she gets into bed, she becomes despondent, yet claims it is beyond her control to get out of bed. As Annette recorded her automatic thoughts one Sunday evening, as seen in Figure 5-4 on the enhancement, it became obvious what her problems were. She was waiting around until she felt the desire, interest, and energy to do something. She was assuming that there was no point in doing anything since she was alone, and she was persecuting and insulting herself because of her inactivity. When she talked back to her thoughts, she reported that the clouds lifted just a bit, so that she was able to get up, take a shower, and get dressed. She then felt even better and arranged to meet a friend for dinner and a movie. As she predicted in the rational responses column, the more she did, the better she felt. If you decide to use this method, be sure you actually write down upsetting thoughts. If you try to figure them out in your head, you will in all probability get nowhere because the thoughts that stymie you are slippery and complex. When you try to talk back to them, they'll come at you even harder from all angles with such speed that you won't even know what hit you. But when you write them down, they become exposed to the light of reason. This way, you can reflect on them, pinpoint the distortions, and come up with some helpful answers. The pleasure predicting sheet. One of Annette's self-defeating attitudes is her assumption that there is no point in doing anything productive if she is alone. Because of this belief, she does nothing and feels miserable, which just confirms her attitude that it's terrible to be alone. Solution: test your belief that there is no point in doing anything by using the pleasure predicting sheet shown in Figure 5-5 on the enhancement. Over a period of weeks, schedule a number of activities that contain a potential for personal growth or satisfaction. Do some of them by yourself and some with others. Record who you did each activity with on the appropriate column and predict how satisfying each will be, between 0 and 100%. Then, go and do them. In the actual satisfaction column, write down how enjoyable each activity really turned out to be. You may be surprised to learn that things you do on your own are more gratifying than you thought. Make sure that the things you do by yourself are of equal quality as those you do with others, so that your comparisons will be valid. If you choose to eat a TV dinner alone, for example, don't compare it with the fancy French restaurant dinner you share with a friend. Figure 5-5 shows the activities of a young man who learned that his girlfriend, who lived 200 miles away, had a new boyfriend and didn't want to see him. Instead of moping in self-pity, he became involved with life. You will notice in the last column that the satisfaction levels he experienced